You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of obstetric brachial plexopathy from the pediatric section on orthobullets.com. Injury to the brachial plexus during birth is usually a stretching injury from a difficult vaginal delivery. However, some rare cases have been reported following C-sections. As far as epidemiology, the incidence of obstetric brachial plexopathy is approximately 1 to 4 per 1,000 live births. However, this is decreasing in frequency due to improved obstetric care. Often, obstetric brachial plexopathy is right-sided or bilateral. Risk factors include babies that are large for gestational age, otherwise known as macrosomia, multiparous pregnancy, difficult presentation, shoulder dystocia, forceps delivery, breech position, and/or prolonged labor. Associated orthopedic conditions include glenohumeral dysplasia, which is characterized by increased glenoid retroversion, humeral head flattening, and posterior humeral head subluxation. This develops in 70% of infants with obstetric brachial plexopathy and is caused by internal rotation contracture and loss of external rotation. Elbow flexion contracture is another associated orthopedic condition with obstetric brachial plexopathy. The etiology is unclear, but it's likely due to persistent relative triceps weakness compared with biceps. And remember that triceps comes from C7 compared with biceps, which comes from C5, C6. Other associated conditions with obstetric brachial plexopathy include clavicle and humerus fractures, as well as torticollis. As far as prognosis, 90% of cases will resolve without intervention. Spontaneous recovery may occur for up to 2 years. Favorable prognostic variables for spontaneous recovery include Erb's palsy, and complete recovery is possible if the biceps and the deltoid are anti-gravity by 3 months. Also, early twitch biceps activity suggests a favorable outcome. Poor prognostic variables for spontaneous recovery include lack of biceps function by 3 months, and preganglionic injuries, which have the worst prognosis. And speaking of preganglionic injuries, avulsions from the cord will not spontaneously recover motor function. So loss of rhomboid function is due to injury to the dorsal scapular nerve, and an elevated hemidiaphragm is due to injury to the phrenic nerve. Horner's syndrome, which is of course ptosis, meiosis, and anhidrosis, is another poor prognostic indicator, as less than 10% recover spontaneous motor function. C7 involvement and Klumpke's palsy are also poor prognostic variables for spontaneous recovery. As far as classification of obstetric brachial plexopathy, the NARICOS classification is the one to know, and this classification system has 4 groups. Group 1 is Duchenne's Erb's palsy, which is associated with a C5-C6 injury and is characterized by paralysis of the deltoid and biceps, however it does have intact wrist and digital flexion/extension. Group 2 is intermediate paralysis, which is associated with a C5 to C7 injury and is characterized by paralysis of the deltoid, biceps, as well as wrist and digital extension. However, it does have intact wrist and digital flexion. Group 3 is a total brachial plexus palsy, which is associated with a C5 to T1 injury and is characterized by a flail extremity without Horner syndrome. And group 4 is a total brachial plexus palsy with Horner syndrome, which is also associated with a C5 to T1 injury and is characterized by a flail extremity with Horner syndrome. As far as presentation, patients will have a lack of active hand and arm motion. On evaluation, the upper extremity exam may show an arm that hangs limp at the side in an adducted and internally rotated position. It may also reveal decreased shoulder external rotation, and the affected shoulder usually subluxates posteriorly. Provocative testing involves stimulating neonatal reflexes, including the Moro reflex, asymmetric tonic neck, and the Vajda reflexes. Pain with gentle shaking of a flail arm may indicate pseudoparalysis from infection or fracture rather than nerve palsy. Part of the general evaluation of obstetric brachial plexopathy patients is using the Hospital for Sick Children Active Movement Scale, which is a muscle strength grading system, and a full range of motion with gravity eliminated gives you a score of 4, and a score of 4 must be achieved before higher scores may be assigned, and higher scores will be against gravity, where less than 50% motion against gravity gives you a score of 5, greater than 50% motion against gravity gives you a score of 6, and full motion against gravity gives you a score of 7. As far as imaging, Radiographs may be useful for evaluation of clavicle or humerus fractures. However, there is limited utility overall for radiographs in infants given minimal ossification of the humeral head and the glenoid. That being said, an axillary view can be obtained to evaluate the position of the humeral head if the patient is older and suspicion is high for joint subluxation. Myelography, CT myelography, or MRI may be used to distinguish between root avulsion and extraforaminal rupture. EMG and nerve conduction velocities have poor reliability and often underestimate the severity of injury. And as far as ultrasound, it allows for assessment of joint subluxation or dislocation. Now let's talk about some of the major obstetric brachial plexopathy lesions in a bit more detail. We'll start with Erb's palsy, which is an upper lesion involving a C5-C6 injury, and this is the most common type of obstetric brachial plexopathy. The mechanism results from lateral flexion of the head towards the contralateral shoulder with depression of the ipsilateral shoulder producing traction on the plexus, and this can occur during a difficult delivery in infants. On physical exam, you may find an adducted internally rotated shoulder, pronated forearm, and extended elbow, otherwise known as a classic waiter's tip position. A C5 deficiency can manifest as an axillary nerve deficiency, suprascapular nerve deficiency, and or a musculocutaneous nerve deficiency. An axillary nerve deficiency is associated with deltoid and teres minor weakness. Suprascapular nerve deficiency is associated with supraspinatus and infraspinatus weakness. And a musculocutaneous nerve deficiency is associated with biceps and brachialis weakness. A C6 deficiency will manifest as a radial nerve deficiency, which is associated with brachioradialis and supinator weakness. As far as prognosis, Erb's palsy has the best prognosis for a spontaneous recovery. Moving on to Klumpke's palsy, which is a lower lesion involving a C8-T1 injury, and this is fairly rare in an obstetric palsy, however the mechanism is usually the arm undergoing severe traction / abduction from the trunk. On physical exam, you may find deficit of all of the small muscles of the hand that are supplied by the ulnar and median nerves. Claw hand is a very specific exam finding where the wrist is in extreme extension because of the unopposed wrist extensors. Hyperextension of the MCP is due to loss of hand intrinsics, and flexion of the IP joints are also due to loss of the hand intrinsics. As far as prognosis for Klumpke's palsy, there is actually a poor prognosis for spontaneous recovery, and this palsy is frequently associated with a preganglionic injury and Horner's syndrome. Total plexus palsy, which involves injury from C5 to T1, is typically due to a severe stretch, rupture, and avulsion injury. Physical exam will show a flaccid arm and both motor and sensory deficits. Imaging should involve a chest radiograph to look for ipsilateral hemidiaphragm paralysis from a phrenic nerve injury. Total plexus palsy has the worst prognosis of all the three plexopathies that we just discussed, as you can imagine. General treatment options can be operative or non-operative. Non-operative management involves observation and daily passive exercises by the parents, and this is indicated as first line of treatment for all obstetric brachial plexopathies while awaiting return of function. The key to treatment is maintaining passive motion while waiting for the nerve function to return. Operative options may include microsurgical nerve grafting, which is indicated for lack of anti-gravity biceps function between 3 to 9 months of age, as well as postganglionic injury with intact nerve roots with segmental injury to the nerve. And as far as outcomes, there are improved outcomes seen with shorter grafts, that is less than 10 centimeters. Nerve transfer or neurotization is another option. Nerve transfer refers to fascicles from one nerve transferred into another nerve that supplies a muscle. Neurotization refers to placing nerve fascicles directly into a neuromuscular junction of a muscle. Indications for these options include lack of anti-gravity biceps function between 3 to 9 months of age and a preganglionic injury or avulsion of nerve roots. Treatment for shoulder dislocations and contractures specifically are usually operative and can include soft tissue procedures like a latissimus dorsi and teres major transfer, otherwise known as the Hoffer procedure. And the indication for this is persistent internal rotation contracture or external rotation weakness without glenohumeral dysplasia. And the technique is to pass tendons posteriorly to create external rotation forces. Another option is a pectoralis major plus or minus subscapularis lengthening, which is indicated to lessen the internal rotation forces and may be used in conjunction with tendon transfers. And finally, arthroscopic release is another option in the setting of internal rotation contractures. Bony procedures for shoulder dislocations and contractures include a proximal humeral derotation osteotomy, otherwise known as a Wickstrom procedure. And this is indicated for persistent internal rotation contracture or external rotation weakness with glenohumeral dysplasia. And arthrodesis is indicated for a non-functional deltoid with good function of the hand and the wrist. Treatment for elbow flexion contractures can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management would involve serial nighttime elbow extension splinting, and this would be indicated for elbow flexion contractures of less than 40 degrees. And as far as outcomes, this non-operative management prevents progression but does not correct contracture. Serial elbow extension casting is another non-operative modality indicated for elbow flexion contractures of greater than 40 degrees. Operative options include an anterior capsular release and a biceps/brachialis tendon lengthening, which is indicated for severe, persistent contractures. And as far as outcomes, you may have a high recurrence rate after these surgeries. As far as treatment of the forearm, operative indications include residual supination contracture of the forearm. And the technique for this is either a biceps rerouting tendon transfer if you have intact passive pronation, or a forearm osteotomy with biceps rerouting tendon transfer if you have limited passive forearm pronation. As far as treatment of the wrist and the hand, operative indications include to replace function for a paralyzed muscle, and remember that force is proportional to cross-sectional area of the muscle and amplitude is proportional to the length of the muscle. But as far as techniques, tendon transfers for wrist drop include pronator teres to the ECRB. Tendon transfers for loss of finger extension include the FCR or FCU to the EDC of digits 2 through 5. And tendon transfers for thumb abduction include EIP to the abductor pollicis brevis. As far as complications of obstetric brachioplexopathy, persistent phrenic nerve palsy from the initial nerve injury may require a diaphragm plication. And surgical complications from shoulder tendon transfers may include iatrogenic radial and axial nerve palsies. That's all for this review about obstetric brachioplexopathy. Hopefully that was helpful. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.